Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating the Battle of Stalingrad, and we'll be finding out how the Russians were able to destroy the German 6th Army and the impact it had on the course of the Second World War. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text 53106, text costs 30 cents, or you could email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we explored the history of the city on two continents and debated what makes Istanbul one of the greatest cities in the world. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. Some great history events coming up this week. On Friday, my colleague Professor Jane Olmeyer of Trinity College Dublin will be delivering the first of the prestigious Ford lectures at the University of Oxford, and because of COVID they will be streamed online free of charge for anyone to watch, and they'll be taking place every Friday over the next 6 weeks. And this year, the lectures, it's the first time they'll be delivered by an historian based in Ireland for over 40 years, and the first time they're being delivered online. The theme is Ireland and Empire, and if you want to watch them, just go to the Oxford webpage by googling James Ford Lectures Oxford, and you'll find the link there for streaming. Jane, of course, is one of our best historians, and I think they're going to be challenging, thought-provoking, and well worth a watch. Now, in tonight's show, we're looking at the Battle of Stalingrad. Starting in August 1942, the siege of Stalingrad became the focal point in the struggle for supremacy between Hitler and Stalin, and ended in a massive defeat for the German 6th Army 5.5 months later. There were massive casualties on both sides, and the battle is often called the turning point in the Second World War in Europe. And so in tonight's show, we want to find out what really happened at Stalingrad, debate whether its impact was real or symbolic, and explore why the battle has resonated with so many people for so long. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Richard Overy is based at Exeter University and is an expert on the history of the Hitler and Stalin dictatorships, the Second World War, and German history in the 20th century. And his books include Goring, The Iron Man, and Dictators, Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia. And his new book, Blood and Runes, A History of the Second World War, will be published later this year. Professor Raina Pennington is Professor of History at Norwich University and is an expert on Soviet military history. Her books include Wings, Woman and War, Soviet Airwomen in World War II, and she's currently working on a new book about what Russia can teach us about war. And Professor Pennington is also a former US Air Force intelligence officer and served as their Soviet analyst. Well, you're both very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to David Stahl, who teaches at the University of New South Wales and the Australian Defence Force Academy, and who is one of the foremost experts on the German invasion of the Soviet Union. And I'll also be talking to James Ellman, a former hedge fund manager turned historian, who's the author of Hitler's Great Gamble, A New Look at German Strategy, Operation Barbarossa, and the Axis Defeat in World War II. But Richard, I might start with you, and I might begin with a broad general question about how significant really was Stalingrad? Was this a symbolic defeat for the Germans and a symbolic victory for the Soviets, or was it genuinely a turning point in the Second World War?
Well, most people think it's a turning point, and I think it certainly has great symbolic value, I mean, both at the time and I think the way we think about the war later on. But I think we need to be very cautious about turning points in the Second World War, because there are a great many turning points. You know, things might have turned up very differently one way or another. If the Germans had won the Battle of Stalingrad, of course, we wouldn't be talking about it at all. I think we need to see it as part of a more general turning point in the war against the Axis. At the very same time, of course, the Germans had been defeated in North Africa, and Rommel was retreating. In the Pacific, the Americans were winning their first victory in Guadalcanal. So in a sense, the whole winter of 1942-43 is a turning point. It's a point at which it's clear that the Axis have overstretched themselves. They've been too ambitious. Their imperial projects are now in danger. But Stalingrad's a long, long way from Berlin, and I think we need to be aware that a great deal has to happen between Stalingrad and the final arrival of the Red Army in the centre of Berlin.
And Richard, I wonder, did it matter the fact that it was called Stalingrad after, the city was called Stalingrad after Stalin? That seems to have made it a point of prestige for Stalin to defend and a point of principle for Hitler to conquer it.
Well, it became that. In fact, at first, Hitler hadn't even intended to capture Stalingrad, just to cut the Volga trade route and so on, surround Stalingrad like Leningrad. And only later did he, as the campaign went on, did he decide he wanted to actually capture Stalingrad. But it did have a symbolic significance. It certainly had for Stalin, because this was the old city of Tsaritsyn, which he had helped to defend during the Russian Civil War. And for Stalin, it had a particular resonance. It had been given his name. And I think that, he had reached a point where he was desperate that Germans were not going to capture it easily, cut the Volga, capture the oil, and so on and so on. So it was partly that it was his city, partly that this was a point at which, he realized the Soviet war effort, it had to be successful at this point, or disaster beckoned. And I think from that point of view, it's both a symbolic city for the two dictators, but it's also a critical battle in the war between the Germans and the Red Army.
And in terms of the leadership of Hitler and Stalin during this time, how would you contrast how they acted?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting contrast, because for a long time Stalin had dominated the Soviet war effort, had intervened all the time in what the Soviet generals were having to do and so on and so on. But this is the point at which he stood back, and increasingly he left it to the Soviet experts. General Zhukov, of course, is the obvious example. But at precisely the point that Hitler began to distrust his own generals more and more and wanted to intervene on every occasion, every trivial point and so on. And so Hitler becomes more embedded in running the war effort and, as it turns out, less successful. And Stalin stands back, and the Red Army, as a result, becomes more successful.
Reina, what would you put the Soviet victory down to? Was it generalship and the, I suppose, the strategy of Zhukov and that counterattack that they do in November? Is it down to the numbers and their determination to keep on going? The fact that they knew they were in a fight to the death? What were the factors that contributed to them succeeding?
Well, there are factors of both quality and quantity. Quantity not in the way that people often think, because in fact the Red Army is outnumbered for much of the defensive phase of the battle. And even in the counteroffensive, overall they've only got about a 2-to-1 advantage, and that's by stripping other parts of the fronts to pull off the counteroffensive. So they ultimately do get some numbers on their side, but it's really the qualitative changes that make the difference. So there's a major shift in training, in tactics, in the production of new equipment, and in particular in the way that they use their armies by the point of the counteroffensive.
And it's fascinating the fact that there are so many women involved on the front line fighting as snipers, firing machine guns in the air, driving tanks, that this was a remarkable joint effort.
Yes, there are thousands of women, military and civilian, combatant and non-combatant, that are in this battle from start to finish, day in and day out. Best estimate on that is somewhere between 20,000 and 60,000 women in the battle. We don't know exactly, because they didn't track women separately in Red Army records. You can guess from names and other ways of getting certain numbers out of this, but it is in the tens of thousands.
And your book showed that, your book explores how the Soviet Union was the first nation to allow women pilots to fly combat missions. And you had some remarkable women pilots during the Battle of Stalingrad, and one who got the name of the White Lily of Stalingrad afterwards and became a hero of the Soviet Union.
Yes, there were 9 female fighter pilots that were sent to Stalingrad in mid-September to fill in as replacements. They went down with their crews, and they were part of the defensive phase. And then a PE-2 dive bomber regiment that was almost entirely staffed by women was deployed during the counteroffensive phase.
And when you look at the ferocity of the fighting, that's something that really struck me reading about Stalingrad, that this was really, you know, hand-to-hand, close quarter, like it, intense bombing as well, and we'll be talking to David Stahl about that, that the people in Stalingrad suffered a major battering, but then the ferocity of the fighting really just stands out.
Yeah, it certainly does, and I might mention here the use of women as scouts, and some of the civilian women and girls that had landed in Stalingrad. For example, there was one girl who at the age of 12 went on 7 scouting missions behind German lines in Stalingrad. And she had started out the war in Leningrad, watched her mother starve to death. She got evacuated and sent to Stalingrad, and there she ended up as the daughter of the regiment, and in that role began doing scouting missions behind German lines.
Richard, what went wrong with the German attack? Was it just this incredible Soviet resistance? Had they got their plans and their strategy wrong? And is it the fact that it just went on for so long that the Russians were able to organise this brilliant counteroffensive?
Well, the strategy was quite wrong. I mean, Hitler was obsessed with capturing the Caucasus oil, cutting the Volga trade routes, and he pushed on and on, well beyond Germany's military capacity. He divided his forces, sending too many south into the Caucasus. He didn't have enough forces to actually take Stalingrad in one blow. So you've got to look at Hitler as the main culprit, if you like, for the failure to take Stalingrad. But so many historians at the moment concentrate on the failures of the Red Army. I mean, I've read a lot recently about how badly trained they were, what, you know, how their staff work was sloppy and inefficient and so on, the troops were cannon fodder, etc., etc. And I do think it's very important at Stalingrad to recognise what Reiner just said, of course, is that the Soviet Army is getting better and better. Its weapons are getting better and better. They're beginning to understand much more how to fight the way the Germans fight. Their air power is much better at Stalingrad. They use radio much more effectively. And I think it's time we kind of turn back this assault on the Red Army, you know, as an inefficient, incompetent, badly led organization. It was an organization getting very much better. Otherwise, they would never have defeated the Germans. And I think that, you know, that's the thing that surprised Hitler and his commanders. They'd assumed that they'd be fighting as they'd been in 1941 and earlier in 1942. You know, the Red Army would be easy to defeat. You know, you surround them, they give up. And they found that Stalingrad a quite different animal altogether. And that's the real turning point, is where the Soviet armed forces suddenly became sophisticated enough to take on the Germans in their own terms and then to defeat them.
And Richard, talk to us about the counteroffensive, because it does seem quite ingenious that when the Soviets appear to be on the back foot and hemmed in, they're able to organise this two-pronged attack. They're able to encircle the German army and cut them off and effectively kind of trap them. And it's a real turning of the tables that probably General Paulus on the German side never would have expected.
They certainly didn't expect it. We need to be clear that it was a gamble. They were going to keep the troops in Stalingrad supplied and fighting, but they were really up against it. And all the reserves were being moved to the north and the south to cut off Stalingrad. It was a gamble. In the end, maybe Chuikov and the other Soviet generals in Stalingrad might have given up before that. But the real success was that the Germans had no idea that the Soviets were capable of developing large reserve forces. German military intelligence said there was no prospect of a Soviet offensive. No warning was really given to the German troops and their allies when Operation Uranus began in November. And so the Soviets were able to spring a complete surprise. Coming back to what I was saying earlier, I mean, this was a point at which the Soviet forces were doing things the Germans had not expected them to be capable of doing. And it was so well planned that this two-pronged operation opened up a huge corridor around Stalingrad, heavily defended, which would then make it impossible for the Germans to penetrate through and to save Paulus. So that was the real key to this part of the strategy. Surround Stalingrad in sufficient depth and sufficient strength to make sure that you would win.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the Battle of Stalingrad. We are talking with some brilliant historians, Professor Richard Overy and Professor Raina Pennington. But we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to David Stahl about the German offensive to capture Stalingrad, the military divisions involved, the huge losses, the bombing campaign, and much more. That's all coming up after the break.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Battle of Stalingrad. I'm delighted to be joined by David Stahl, who teaches at the University of New South Wales and the Australian Defence Force Academy, and who is one of the foremost experts on the German invasion of the Soviet Union. His books include Operation Barbarossa and Germany's Defeat in the East, as well as The Battle for Moscow, and his new book is Soldiers of Barbarossa, Combat on the Eastern Front. David, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when we look at the reasons why Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, I wonder, is there a case to be made that the whole war strategy was doomed from the start?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonably fair assumption. A lot of people have this idea that the German Wehrmacht is conquering all before it, and certainly before Stalingrad, the Wehrmacht is unassailable. And that's a very incorrect conception. The German army consists in the invasion of the Soviet Union of about 150 divisions, but only about 30 of those divisions are motorized or panzer divisions. And that's what this propaganda that the newsreels have made famous, the Goebbels image of the Wehrmacht that we see on our screens, this motorized, mobile, rapid German army. The rest of the German army is actually infantry that march into the Soviet Union. There are 600,000 horses in that army. So this idea that it's a rapid, fast-moving army is a misconception. And it also means that when they suffer casualties in the invasion, it's happening typically in this very tip of the spear, you might say, in the panzer groups, where these motorized and panzer divisions are concentrated. So Germany has a very finite amount of resources that it can afford to expend in the campaign. And the same is not true for the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union has 5.3 million men in the Red Army before the Germans invade, and they have a 14 million man mobilization base. That means that their force generation is far better. They can sustain many more casualties, and they can constantly raise new armies. They raise 13 in July, and they raise another 14 field armies in August 1941. And actually, the Red Army grows over the course of 1941. So by the end of the year, it's up to 8 million men. Now, that's not to say that those men are of the same proficiency that the starting Red Army has, but there they are. They're in the field, and the Germans are left trying to confront them, and they're doing it with panzer groups that are greatly that they've suffered a great deal of attrition.
Can you talk to me then about the German offensive to capture Stalingrad, and what were the key military divisions involved?
I mean, we often talk about this Stalingrad campaign, but I think it's very important to understand that Stalingrad is only one small part of the initial Operation Blue conception of a summer campaign for 1942. So the Germans aren't looking to take Stalingrad. That's not the initial idea. That's, in fact, a very secondary idea. It's only mentioned once in the whole German plan. The actual idea is to drive into southern Russia, down into the Caucasus, and seize vital resources, chief among them oil. And in doing that, they're going to have to secure the northern flank of this operation, and they're going to do that along the Volga because that allows you the economy of force. And one of the big cities on the Volga is, of course, Stalingrad. And that's really where we see the only mention of it. So the campaign is basically being launched because the Germans lack the resources for a long war, and they can't afford an offensive across the entirety of the Eastern Front. The initial part of the campaign is very successful, but that belies the weakness of the German forces. Most of the Red Army is marshaled in the central part of the Eastern Front, expecting that the German forces are going to make another attempt to seize Moscow, which is what they tried in the autumn of 1941 and failed to do. And it's therefore open to some extent in the south for for the Germans to concentrate their forces and make very considerable gains in the summer of 1942. Stalin does react. They begin with an order about a month into the German campaign, the famous Order 227, which is not a step back. But of course, the Red Army is still being pushed back, but there are reserves that they can afford to bring down from the north. And the Germans are also, just like in 1941, losing strength with distance. It's not just the Red Army that attrits the Red, that attrits the Wehrmacht. It's also this tyranny of distance in the east. Keep in mind, Stalingrad is 2,200 kilometers from Berlin. That's an enormous distance. And beyond the fact that the German forces aren't that strong to begin with, keep in mind there's hundreds of thousands of Romanians, Italians, Hungarians that are drafted in without really the training, the doctrine, and the heavy equipment to sustain another large offensive. And they're all being pushed into this southern operation. About a month in, they split the army group south into two army groups. Army Group A is going to go onto the Caucasus Mountains to get the oil, and Army Group B is going to cover this northern sector. And it's the 6th Army, which belongs to Army Group B, that's going to end up at Stalingrad. And of course, the most famous part of this campaign becomes all of this urban combat that we see in and around the city. And while it's the subject of so many books that people talk about the battle for this, you know, factory and this grain silo and all the rest of it, in real terms, not much of that makes a big difference. The real campaign is far larger, extending a long way to the north and obviously way down into the south. And it's ultimately in this attritional war that's going to roll on for weeks and weeks through the autumn that in that time the Red Army is marshalling its reserves, and it has a lot of reserves. The Germans underestimate how many reserves it has, and they're going to begin this planetary offensive system, which is initiated with Operation Uranus. That's the famous operation that encircles the German 6th Army at Stalingrad. But there are other staged offensives, not just in the south, that's going to be followed up with, which is Operation Saturn. After the elimination of the Stalingrad group, they're going to push on and try and cut off Army Group A. But there's actually other offensives in the north, Operation Mars, to try and capture a place called Rzeszów, and then they want to exploit that with Jupiter. Now, those other operations aren't as successful, but Operation Uranus certainly is. It not only cuts off the German 6th Army, but it is more effective than they anticipate because they don't know how many men are in the Stalingrad pocket. They guessed it was something around 100,000. Turns out it's 250,000. And of course, over the winter, that force will be reduced. The pocket will be reduced and reduced until ultimately the German attempt to relieve it, Operation Winterstorm, fails, and the German 6th Army, with 90,000 prisoners of war, ends up in Soviet captivity.
Incredible. And during the campaign, the Luftwaffe reduced Stalingrad to rubble with direct assaults on civilians. I wonder, do we know exactly how many civilians were killed and just how destructive that bombing campaign was?
It was definitely destructive. We have estimates. So in 1939 is the last figure we have for what the population of Stalingrad was. It was 445,000, but clearly by the time the Luftwaffe is in range of Stalingrad, their numbers have been swelled by refugees fleeing eastward and by Red Army troops, which are starting to arrive in the city. So the best estimates suggest that the most famous raid, which is the 23rd of August 1942, where 600 aircraft strike the city, somewhere between 25,000 and 40,000 people are killed. Now, that's quite extraordinary. It's a large number of people. But older estimates have suggested that the numbers were much higher, and that tends not to be the case.
And then finally, what do you see as, I suppose, the legacy of the Battle of Stalingrad and indeed the legacy of Operation Barbarossa as an entire entity?
Oh, yeah, that's a very big question. You know, I think that for an Anglo-American audience, the thing I find myself often thinking is that we see the Eastern Front as just being one more of the many fronts that Germany fights on. And I think that the enduring legacy of Barbarossa, but also Stalingrad, is to be underlined by numbers. Rommel, the most famous German general for us, he commands in the course of these campaigns no more than three German divisions. That's less than 50,000 men in North Africa. And at the same time, the Germans invade the Soviet Union with more than 3 million men. As I said before, 150 divisions. And the numbers aren't just large, the casualties also reflect this. So we are talking hundreds of thousands of German deaths in the first 18 months of the war. And those sorts of figures aren't seen anywhere else by the Western Allies. And at no point in the war did we get close to what the Eastern Front exacts in terms of the cost. And that's large for the Wehrmacht, but it's even larger for the Red Army, which is part of why I think understanding modern Russia is really understanding the role in the Second World War, because I think that the Russians often feel that we don't understand the role they played in the war. I mean, each country emphasizes its own history, but this is a country that loses 27 million people. And some of those are military deaths, but there's a very large number of civilian deaths as well. And I guess that's, if you give me 30 seconds more, that's the other thing I'd emphasize. It's an enormous war in terms of scale, but it's also a genocidal war. The Holocaust begins in the East. There is no death camps. It's mass shootings of Jews, 600,000 in 1941. And parallel to that, there's a war of annihilation that the Wehrmacht fights against the Soviet people. It's been in all different ways, criminal orders, anti-partisan campaigns, scorched earth policies. And this results in the course of a four-year occupation, or mainly a three-year occupation, actually, this results in millions of Soviet civilians being killed. And that's separate from the military campaign. And it just underlines how destructive the war in Eastern Europe was, and often much more so than Anglo-Americans really appreciate.
Okay, well, it's been brilliant talking to you, David Stile. We'll be back with more on the Battle of Stalingrad right after this break.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Battle of Stalingrad. I'm delighted to be joined all the way from Hawaii by James Ellman, who's a former hedge fund manager turned historian, and he's the author of Hitler's Great Gamble, A New Look at German Strategy, Operation Barbarossa and the Axis Defeat in World War II. James, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Can we begin with a broad question about what went wrong for the German army during this time? Because some accounts put it all down to their failure at Moscow, whereas others say that it was down to what happened at Stalingrad. How would you view things?
Well, many do say that the Germans lost World War II when they failed to take Moscow in 1941 as the winter set in. But that certainly flies in the face of the facts, which is in the spring of 1942, the Germans launched a massive offensive across the Ukraine, which took them all the way a couple of thousand kilometers from Berlin to the banks of the Volga and the city then known as Stalingrad, where the German advance was eventually slowly and inexorably stopped, and the Germans were thrown back and began the long retreat that took them all the way to Berlin and the end of the war.
And why did the Soviet army win at Stalingrad or prevail at Stalingrad? What was it that, was it the sheer determination not to give in? What were the factors that led to that?
It was, to a great extent, multifaceted. One, of course, as you said, was the Red Army was unwilling to give in. One reason they were unwilling to give in was due to harsh discipline. More than 100,000 Red Army soldiers were executed by the NKVD, Soviet Internal Security Service, for fleeing the battlefield. Many times Red Army soldiers had to make the decision between either fighting and likely dying against the Germans, either in battle or in POW camps, or assured death with the bullet from the NKVD if they ran from the battlefield. Another was, of course, just great patriotism on the Russian army. The Russians had been invaded over the last few hundred years prior to the Battle of Stalingrad by the Poles, the Swedes, the French, and then the Germans in 1914. So this was just one in a string of invasions that every couple of generations of Russians had to fight off an invasion from the West. Finally, the Germans, of course, along with their allies, and most people don't seem to know that more Hungarians, Romanians, and Italians died fighting on the German side than Germans did in the Battle of Stalingrad. It was a multifaceted army that had invaded and pushed its way to the Volga. The Germans just didn't have enough troops, and its supply lines were quite stretched. And finally, one final point that makes that gets a little shift is that the United States Lend-Lease effort supplied a couple of million tons of aid to the Soviet Union in 1942, everything from aircraft to cans of Spam that fed the Red Army. And those supplies allowed the Soviets to strip their agricultural regions and many of their industrial regions of workers and put them on the front lines. So it was very much an entire world effort that came to a head for both sides at the Battle of Stalingrad. And of course, the Axis broke and began the long descent to defeat.
And it's interesting that after the war, some significant Russian figures on the political and military side were prepared to acknowledge how significant that U.S. aid was.
That was in fact correct, including Khrushchev, who became, of course, the premier of the Soviet Union, as well as Marshal Zhukov, likely the greatest general of World War II, but we don't hear that much about him in the West. Though much of that information was suppressed during the Cold War. The communists did not want to give a great deal of credit to the United States for being able to supply their soldiers with what they needed to do the fighting and the dying, but they wouldn't have been able to do that fighting without U.S. Lend-Lease aid. And it was only after the fall of the Iron Curtain that we really got all that information when the Soviet archives were finally opened.
And it's fascinating what you say about the fact that the German army was made up of people from different countries as well, Italy, Romania and Hungary, and also some Soviet citizens were part of it as well.
Absolutely. Many tens of millions of Soviet citizens joined the Axis effort. Many of them were not ethnic Russians. They were ethnicities that many of which were uprooted by Stalin and sent off to Siberia and not to return for decades due to their assistance with the invaders. In fact, the Sixth Army, the German Sixth Army, which was encircled and eventually forced to surrender at the end of the Battle of Stalingrad, had more than 25% of its active troops were Hiwis or helper workers, helper fighters who the Germans had recruited from Soviet citizens. Many of those Hiwis fought even more persistently than the Germans did, knowing that they would likely be executed on the spot by the Red Army if they were to be captured.
So what about after the battle then? Because sometimes when you read accounts, it seems like it's all over for the German war effort after Stalingrad and that they're just pushed back all the way to Berlin. But there still is a huge amount of fighting still that goes on.
Thinking maybe more along the lines of, to paraphrase Prime Minister Churchill, it really was more the end of the beginning rather than the beginning of the end for the German army in the Soviet Union at the end of the Battle of Stalingrad. It did unhinge their advance that had taken them south into the Caucasus all the way down towards the shores of the Caspian and the oil fields there, which they had tried to seize. They were forced to retreat. But we may recall that the Battle of Stalingrad ended early in 1943, and it wasn't until the end of 1944 that the Germans were finally expelled from the Soviet Union. In fact, the Red Army suffered significantly more casualties in 1943 than it did in 1942, and an even more significant amount in 1944 plus 1945 in the final year and a half of the war. So the Germans did not go away quietly after the loss at the Battle of Stalingrad. In fact, their retreat was quite determined. It was tenacious and extremely effective. And to a great extent, it was only due to the opening of the real Second Front by the Western Allies in France that forced the Germans to strip their lines of troops and allowed the Soviets to advance more quickly.
And finally, James, do you think they made the same mistakes as Napoleon when he invaded Russia? Did they make different mistakes? And why didn't they learn from what had gone wrong with Napoleon in the 19th century?
I believe that the Germans made different mistakes than Napoleon. Napoleon's troops, clearly there are some similarities, both Napoleon's army, his Grand Army, and the German Wehrmacht, certainly had a great deal of pain and suffering from the harsh Soviet or Russian winter, and were not as well prepared for it as they could and should have been. Of course, we should recall that the Russians fighting against them suffered from the winter just the same way. I believe in the second half of my book, Hitler's Great Gamble argues that the major mistake the Germans made in invading the Soviet Union was not getting their two most militarily capable allies, the Finns and the Japanese, to join in the war with them. The Japanese not invading in Siberia allowed Stalin to strip almost a million trained soldiers from Siberia and ship them on the Trans-Siberian Railway west to join the battle against the Germans. It also allowed the port of Vladivostok to remain open. And from there, almost half of all aid from the United States flowed in right past the Japanese fleet, even in the middle of World War II, as long as those ships were crewed by Soviets and flew a Soviet flag. The Finns also were cajoled and entered the war, but they were unwilling to lead to a real breach with the United States, and they did not sever the railway to Murmansk in the north, nor take Murmansk itself. So huge amounts of military supplies flowed in the north as well. Finally, part of the rationale for the Battle of Stalingrad was to take the Volga, where aid was starting to flow in from the British and the Americans through Iran, then Persia, up through the Caspian, and then up the Volga. So cutting that supply line was an important component of the German offensive that led them to Stalingrad.
Okay, well, James, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you tonight. James Ellman, the author of Hitler's Great Gamble, a new look at German strategy, Operation Barbarossa, and the Axis defeat in World War II. James, thanks so much.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back after this break when we'll be looking at the impact and legacy of the Battle of Stalingrad.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the Battle of Stalingrad. Before the break there, we heard from James Ellman, and before that, David Stahl. And I'm rejoined now by our panellists, Professor Richard Overy and Professor Raina Pennington. And Richard, I'd like to ask you about the impact of the Battle of Stalingrad on, I suppose, world opinion, on German opinion. And it seems that people in Germany didn't really know how badly things had gone in Stalingrad until probably a year or more later.
Well, no, I think they did know much straight away. I mean, there was a pall of gloom that descended on Germany in February and March 1943. But I think, and it's something that we've talked about earlier in this programme, Stalingrad is a long way from Berlin. And I think, you know, even with that defeat, most German people didn't expect that to lead eventually to Germany's complete defeat and destruction. So, you know, after a few months, people picked up again. They thought, you know, things will work out differently, perhaps, but they didn't see it in quite that terminal way. But elsewhere in the world, I think that the impact of Stalingrad was enormous, because for years, all the Allies had had was defeats, quite catastrophic defeats. Alamein, of course, was a victory, but as we've heard, it was against three German divisions, not 200. I think for world opinion, the defeat at Stalingrad, which the Soviets made a great deal of, did seem to them to be a real turning point. It was the first point at which the most dangerous of the Axis powers, Germany, had been stopped, defeated, and hundreds of thousands of its soldiers taken into captivity. And I think that was really the turning point in world opinion. After that, it's hard to find anywhere in the Western world among the Allied powers a failure of confidence. After that, there was confidence that however long it would take, however hard it would be, and it was a long and hard war, the Allies would eventually win it.
And Richard, it seemed that Hitler was very disappointed at the German final surrender. I think he thought that the generals like Paulus should have just committed suicide rather than give up.
Well, yes, but I mean that's Hitler all over. He thought everybody should commit suicide if they fail. And in Japanese military culture, of course, that's what they do. They commit suicide when they fail. But there was no reason for Paulus to commit suicide. In fact, Paulus's resentment was really against Hitler, putting him into a situation which he couldn't win. I think a great many other German generals felt the same after Stalingrad. And indeed, we know that throughout the course of 1943, some German officers planned to assassinate Hitler, and eventually they tried to assassinate him, of course, 18 months later. So yes, commit suicide. What was the point from Paulus's point of view?
Yeah, an excellent text in from David on 53106 to say that some stats during this period are startling. For example, that the USSR with more than 300,000 trucks during the Second World War. So the war is really a victory on the Soviet side for American industrial output and Russian blood. Brian in Cork saying that there is always a paradox in attacking Russia, given the vastness of the country and the climate. The more successful you are, the more difficult it is to sustain your attack. Raina, what is it about the Battle of Stalingrad that has resonated with the public for so many years? That there are so many books, fiction and non-fiction about it, documentaries, movies, that there's something about the story and the starkness of it and the ferocity of it that really, I think resonates with people and has captured the imagination of people.
I think a lot of that has to do with the perception that this is all about urban warfare, and that's a gripping, compelling thing. And I think a lot of our perception was shaped by German memoirs about the point in the battle when they are the victims, and that's our normal thought of what's going on at Stalingrad, and it's really not very accurate. So it's easy to overlook that the majority of the operations are actually going on outside the city, and the strategic point of all of this, as others have pointed out, is in the Caucasus, and it's really about Army Group A. And the failure of Army Group A is much more important than what happens in Stalingrad. That's been lost in the popular perceptions because the Germans didn't want to talk about that.
And Raina, Raina?
Yeah, let me just tell your listeners that there's a lot of new information that's come out of the archives just in the last 10 and 15 years on this, on primarily on the Red Army side, but a lot on the German side, too. There's been some new things that have been discovered in archives that's made our understanding much more accurate and much more sophisticated. So there's some new information on things like Order 227 and what was really going on there, and that a very small number of people were actually executed, and that penal units were the main venue of rehabilitating soldiers that were thought to have deserted or showed cowardice. We've got new understanding on Lend-Lease as well, and a lot of information coming about that. I would say that at the time of Stalingrad, Lend-Lease was not yet playing a major part. Trucks were beginning to arrive in some significant numbers that helped in the counteroffensive, but almost all the weapon systems were being produced by the Soviets themselves at that point. And that was a miracle of industrial effort that happened. If you know about the movement of 1,500 factories from Ukraine primarily to the Ural Mountains and then starting to go back into production. So it's a sophisticated thing to study that's much more complicated, much more interesting, I think, than is often believed.
And Raina, is that something that you find when you teach the Battle of Stalingrad with your students? I think you're doing an entire course on it with this semester with your students. And are there aspects of it that are in the popular perception, but then when you dig into it, that it changes how we understand the battle and its significance?
Yes, yes. And that's been marvelous. You know, last semester with my students, their perceptions tend to be shaped by some very bad movies and video games that focus on the tactical level, which is what we like to look at, especially Americans. We just like things that happen in a few days and at very small, lower levels of the military. We don't like the grand strategy where it gets messy and where there's as much politics as military force involved. So there's really interesting things to look at in this battle, and you've got to get to the much bigger picture to understand it. You cannot understand Stalingrad without understanding Operation Blue, as David was talking about in the summer of 42, without looking at what's happening in the Caucasus Mountains, which is just as bloody and hard fought as what happens in Stalingrad, the city. So, you know, the picture is so much more rich and interesting than people often recognize.
And Raina, is it possible to get anywhere close to an exact figure for the numbers of dead and wounded? Because I suppose it's hard to do it when you've got so many civilian casualties, and then hard to get, I suppose, the numbers for the opposing armies.
That's it, exactly. The civilian casualties make it difficult. So we have a pretty good idea about the military casualties, the deaths running around 11 million. And depending on the figures you see some differences there. But civilian casualties are really tough to count. And that's true in anywhere, anytime, in any place. And so that's why in the Soviet Union and in China in World War II, the figures still have a margin of error in the millions.
So sorry, for the battle then on the Soviet side, what, 1 million casualties?
That's a little high, I think. You'll see that in different sources. So that's something that's still in some flux and is hotly debated by Russian scholars in Russia and outside, depending on how you read different numbers. But the common figures, that soldiers never lasted longer than a day and that there were a million deaths are a little bit exaggerated. Not that it's not a very bloody, bloody affair.
Richard, what would you see as the legacy of the battle then? That it's maybe not quite the turning point, or maybe that it's one of a number of turning points in the Second World War?
Well, I think we know so much more now about the German-Soviet War than we knew 20 years ago that we can be clear this isn't just a turning point. I mean, I've always favoured the Battle of Kursk, of course, 6 months later, which is, to my mind, a much more decisive battle. And one which really does determine that the Germans are on a long retreat. But the legacy is going to live on, because I think, coming back to what Rainer was saying, I mean, this is a battle of extraordinary drama. And in the history of the Second World War, there's quite a lot of drama, but I think for most people, this is one of the most dramatic moments in the Second World War. And I think, to the extent that a wider public wants drama, wants its war to be exciting, the Battle of Stalingrad will always be a key reference point, even though all the things that we've heard about this evening make it clear that Stalingrad itself is perhaps overrated, and that Stalingrad itself was not perhaps the turning point. I think that in terms of World War II drama, this is a battle which will live on and on. I'd like to, if I have a chance, actually just add something to what we've heard already, I think, about the battle.
Oh, please, definitely.
I was quite right that Lend-Lease, is not that important yet by December 42. And the idea that we heard earlier in the program that somehow, America contributed to the Soviet victory, I think is greatly exaggerated, and I think we should contest that.
Okay, interesting. Okay,
the
so we're changing
David's
that.
David's view about the bombing and civilian deaths, and I just wanted to add very quickly, but I've done work on the civil defense records from Stalingrad, which, as far as I know, nobody else has. And the figures of the dead from bombing is much smaller, even than 25,000. I don't have it at more than a few thousand, in fact, because of the scale of the Luftwaffe attack and so on and so on. So I think the idea that tens of thousands of civilians died in Stalingrad as part of the battle is also something that's greatly overstated.
And Richard, do you think that the Battle of Stalingrad fed into Soviet self-confidence after the Second World War, when it seemed to have re-energized Stalin, and it seems to have become this hugely important thing in terms of his prestige and his self-image, and their confidence on the world stage seem to have been emboldened by this?
No, absolutely, because they won many other bigger battles and more important battles in some ways, but this did have an extraordinary symbolic influence, both in the Soviet Union and outside. And it's been a constant reference point. The argument we've already heard, I think, this evening, that somehow or other Soviets always think that the West played down their war effort, never took it seriously enough and so on. Well, Stalingrad is one thing they always throw out. Then look at Stalingrad, and then look at Alamein, three divisions. And you look at Stalingrad and the 300,000 dead on each side, you think, this is a completely different scale. This is something else. This is a war like the Great War.
Very good. Okay, well, I think that's a very good point on which to end our discussion tonight on the Battle of Stalingrad. My thanks to my panellists who've been with me for the whole hour. Professor Richard Avery of Exeter University. His new book, Blood and Runes, A History of the Second World War, will be published later this year. His stuff is always excellent. I'm really looking forward to hopefully have him back on to the show for that. Also, Professor Raina Pennington, Professor of History at Norwich University, has done brilliant work on Soviet military history. And we were also joined by David Stahl, author of Operation Barbarossa and Germany's Defeat in the East, based in the University of New South Wales, and James Ellman, the author of Hitler's Great Gamble, which takes a new look at German strategy. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be talking about Hollywood's unfinished journey from racism to reconciliation, finding out about the invasion of Sicily in 1943 and the lessons that were learned for D-Day, and discussing how Winston Churchill used the news to develop his image. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.